This is a download from the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. Civil rights attorney Oliver Hill is well known for the role he played in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decisions that ended the doctrine of separate but equal and other forms of racial discrimination in the United States. One of the cases in which Hill was a key figure was the NAACP versus Button. On its face, Button was a challenge to Virginia statutes defining and punishing attorney malpractice. The impact of the 1963 decision was, however, far greater. NAACP versus Button established the principle that active encouragement to public interest litigation is speech protected by the First Amendment, a principle that was critical to civil rights litigation. In February 2000, the Thomas Jefferson Center sponsored a conference at Howard University on the lasting impact of the decision. Prior to the conference, Center Director Robert O'Neill interviewed Hill about his involvement in the case. Hill was 93 years old at the time of the interview, and his voice is sometimes weak, making it occasionally difficult to hear his comments. His mind is sharp, however, making it worth the effort of concentrating to hear his comments.
Mr. Hill, this is a great honor and an opportunity for us to have a chance to visit with you and get your memories and reflections and impressions of this extraordinarily important case. It's now been 36 years, more than 36 years from the date of decision. It is no less important today than it ever has been. So if I could just ask you to recollect a bit, to recall a few things. Let me start, if I can.
Let me warn you, Nate. Yeah. You're coming up on against a reasonable, what do you say? I can't think of the word right this moment, but my guy controlled his memory. Go ahead.
So far, I have found your recall to be impeccable, and I have no reason to think otherwise. On the other hand, we're not obviously searching for details or particulars, but more a sense of your general recollections about the case. And I thought the point at which I might start is to go back to these statutes that were passed in the 1950s for whatever purpose. They obviously severely restricted the activities of lawyers in the public interest field. Was there ever any doubt that a test case would be filed here in Virginia to challenge those laws, or was that always something that was seen as an imperative and essential step?
Well, unquestionably, as a matter of fact, because Henry makes it more dramatic than I think it was, but I challenged them when they were enacting the darn things. I told them, you can pass them, but we're going to challenge them and we're going to defeat you. And all we're going to do is waste all our time. The trouble about these darn laws, brother, we wasted so much time and effort. They tied us up holding hearings. See, they had two legislative committees functioning, Thompson Committee, Senator Thompson, from the Senate, and Boatwright Committee in the House. And they would hold hearings around different places in the South, in the thing, trying to get the membership names so that they could harass the members. And that took up a heck of a lot of our time, and we had to go to, we'd hear the committees, we refused to answer the darn question, and then they'd take us to court, and the court would rule against us, and we'd appeal. And so all that was tying up, wasting a whole lot of time. We didn't get to them until as soon as we did. Then when we did get filed the suit against Harrison, see Thurgood and Spott filed the suit on behalf of the Inc. Fund. We called it the Inc. Fund. In those days, they called LFD, Legal Defense Fund now. But and then Bob Carter and I filed a suit on behalf of the NAACP proper. And I got involved in the Kennedy campaign, and we ultimately got involved in administration. And Thurgood went to the bench, so there was, I was changing lawyers too on that in that regard. So all these things took up time. Then they see that what was known as Pullman Doctrine. That's something Justice Frankfurter resurrected. In administrative affairs, you get to let the proper state administrative people pass on, get their version of the constitutionality of things. And so when we filed suit, they on two or three of them, I can't remember exactly which ones they were now, but they said they have to, we'd have to go over to the state court, get that. But now, here these people have been, see, they did that on all these doggone things. And people have been discriminating for centuries. And why are you going to waste time getting that version? Everybody knew what the devil they were going to do. They were segregationists. They were going to uphold segregation as long as they could. They had announced that. That was an established purpose. And you must remember that when the Supreme Court decision came out, you had the Congressional Manifesto, and all but about three congressmen, members of the Congress, signed it. And it's never been repealed yet. And they urged people to avoid the decision, to resist it, to do everything legal to not comply with it. But how are you going to legally not comply with the law? With that type of atmosphere, it didn't make sense to me for them to force us to do a whole lot of things they did. But that was the situation we were confronted with, and that took up time and effort.
And I assume, among other things, the decision to file in state court rather than federal had to do with that abstention.
Oh, no, we filed in federal court. We only went to state court because they said we had to.
You undoubtedly would have ended up in state court anyway, because of the abstention issue. Wherever you had started, I guess it was inevitable you'd have to go through the state courts.
Yeah, we were trying to avoid the state court possible.
In terms of possible plaintiffs, was there any thought given to having individuals as plaintiffs rather than the organization, or was that always the...
No, the organization was in a protective position. We filed on behalf of some individuals, and those individuals have been harassed. If there's any way possible for them to lost their employment, they might have been lost their employment. All kinds of things of that nature were happening. Every time we filed, we used individuals in a number of situations, but there were always repercussions.
So that makes, whereas the organization, dealing with a representative body.
And besides, the organization was part of the statute, you know. They made the organization a part of a statute. And if they didn't have a direct financial interest in whatever was happening, they were violating the law by bringing suits and that sort of thing.
In terms of remedies, possible outcomes, I assume you hoped for a declaratory judgment and an injunction. That would really vindicate the position.
Yeah, we eventually got what we wanted, was a declaration that the statutes were unconstitutional and unenforceable.
And having reaching that conclusion, was there a concern that the General Assembly would just come along right behind and maybe not reenact it in words, but would patch it up in some way if the decision were narrow, that it could be circumvented?
Well, it was just a chance you had to take, I guess. I don't know. If you recall, the civil rights, that was the interpretation they gave to the 14th Amendment. You see, within the civil rights statutes, where the Congress, so, and the funny part, they call it always referred to as the radical Republican Congress, where the Congress enacted laws that made it required innkeepers to provide services to Negroes like they did to white people. And although Virginia was a common law state, and the United States was a common law country, and obviously the words "no state" was put in there to mean that even the state couldn't do it, not that it was limited to the states. No state had operated any inns or hotels or anything prior to that, so why would it restrict it to action by the state? The purport of the language was even a state couldn't do it. But they gave that narrow interpretation to the 14th Amendment provision and allowed individuals to discriminate against Negroes and allowed the state to enact laws enforcing the individual's right to deny Negroes the privileges. See, under the old common law, any traveler was entitled to food and lodging. The only restriction was that he had to pay for it.
When you began this process, did you expect to win eventually, given the state of the law as it then was?
Well, I don't know where I got that optimism from, but you see, my stepfather had a brother who was a lawyer. He was working in the government at the time, but he was doing, had an evening practice, and he was expecting to eventually become a full-time lawyer. But anyway, he had a cerebral hemorrhage and died. And his widow gave me a 1924 annotated code of Constitution of the United States. And she gave me several of his books, but the first one was that book. And naturally, I read the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, and I didn't see why they didn't why the Virginia segregation laws didn't infringe upon the 14th Amendment. So I went down to Congress. I'm a sophomore in college now, and at that time, and I'm one of these happy-go-lucky C students, you know. You all have heard of them, I'm sure. And
even know a few.
So I went down to the Library of Congress and got the cases and read them, and they didn't make any sense to me either. But then at that time, you see, in 1928, you couldn't get a law through Congress making a crime to lynch Negro, much less do anything to allow him political progress or privilege. So it occurred to me the only thing to do would be take another case back to the Supreme Court and convince them they were wrong the first time. Now I say, no way, I got the idea that it could be done. But I decided I'd go to law school and do it. That's what I did. It was sort of like a story. It's pretty Kevin Currency right present time. It seemed like there was a young white in the early part of this century, during the first decade, a little white boy and a little Negro boy. They were friends, and the airplane went by, traveling at excessive speed, about 25, 30 miles an hour. And the little white boy said to the Negro boy, the white man is operating that machine, and said, "Don't you wish you were white, so when you grow up, maybe you could learn how to operate a machine like that?" And the little Negro boy thought about it for a minute or two. Then he turned around and said, "You know, I bet you, if I had the opportunity to learn, I could operate that machine black as I is." And so I think maybe that's what, I didn't go through all the steps that he went through, but I think I just jumped over to that conclusion that if I was properly trained, I could do it. And so happened, this is a really long story. I'm not going to get into this. Really long story. It was the most fortuitous situation that could have happened for me, because a wide range of things were happening right at that particular time, involving other people. Charlie Houston was given the chance to make Howard University School of Law a full-time day school and a full-time law school. And so many other things. Mordecai Johnson, the president of Howard University at that time, had undertaken this program. He employed Charlie to do it. And a young millionaire received a large bequest. He didn't say he didn't earn it. Hell, he didn't want it. He gave it to the NAACP to fight segregation. See, I say it wasn't. It just turned out just so many things just came together, and I just happened to fall into it. Okay. I'll try not to be so long.
Oh, that's fascinating. No, I please do digress. Ruby is here and may want to join in, too. We've got microphones to go around. So you were optimistic when you started out.
Yeah, from the get-go, yeah.
There were some strategic choices between the two cases, I gather. Could you say a bit about...
You mean, optimistic from... I mean, cases between what?
Well, that eventually this issue might not be immediately, but that this was an issue which eventually was going to get resolved favorably. That, at least, was your belief. Was that shared among the NAACP legal strategists?
Oh, no. Well, yeah, I think we figured we would eventually win, but when this young man gave us money to NAACP, Charlie, they asked Charlie to determine how to go about it. And Charlie engaged one of his classmates at Harvard, a guy named Margo, and he came up with a plan that we ought to attack education. And then he suggested that we file suits all over the South simultaneously. Well, challenging segregation per se. Well, Charlie analyzed that and didn't think it was feasible for several reasons. One, we didn't have the manpower. Now, we just, my class now is just starting in law school while this is going on. And the second thing was, he regarded challenging segregation per se would be like batting your head up against a stone wall. And these subsequent events established the correctness of his decision. So he reasoned that what we ought to do is do what they say, challenge them at their point. They say it's separate, the law is separate but equal. All right, so we challenge the equality. And we knew it, everybody knew everything, nothing was nothing. They were separate and equal. And particularly in education, the inequality was actually ridiculous. Few pennies for Negroes, dollars, $1 for white folks. So when we finished law school, and that's when we got started with the program, Charlie went to NAACP as special counsel. And that's the way we attacked the thing. And the first things we attacked was the unequal pay to Negro teachers. Most places, the salary scales for 1 year, you were limited to 1 year, and they didn't have to give you any reason for not re-employing you. And the usual salary scale for Negroes, the top salary scale for Negroes was below the lowest salary he had a salary for whites. So, for example, here in Richmond, it went from about $350 up to $999 for Negroes. Started at $1,000 for whites, went up to about $1,700 or $1,800. And that was characteristic all over the state. Figures might be different places, but so we challenged those things, we went out developing support among the people for the NAACP and for programs, and we did a lot of legwork on that in that manner. We also recognized the fact that we have to educate the courts and also educate Negroes so far as challenging segregation was concerned, because see, whole lot of them felt all we were going to do was make bad matters worse. And so we had that to contend with. So, but if you must remember now, between the time that Thurgood and I entered law school, we were classmates, we entered the same year, 1930. From the time we entered law school until the time we got the first decision, 1954, was 24 years. That's a heck of a long time on anybody's life. But meantime, a whole lot of things were happening. In between that, Thurgood got a Maryland decision when the Murray case allowed Negroes to go to University of Maryland. We didn't get a plaintiff and a case won in Virginia until 1950. And that was a case of Swanson case, in which they denied the man right to get a graduate degree. He wanted to get a master's. He had already finished law school at Howard, and he was working for us, working for the firm. And we were challenged to segregation on everything, juries, inequality in schools, just anything, you name it, we were challenged if it came under segregation law. But we didn't challenge segregation, we just challenged the inequality and got considerable support.
When you came to challenging these particular Virginia laws restricting public interest litigation, do you think it was helpful? Certainly to the Supreme Court majority, it became helpful, but did you feel when you set out on this path that it would be helpful to have done all the kinds of school and other litigation in which NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund had been involved?
As a matter of fact, we didn't file a suit challenging segregation per se until we got the Sweat versus Painter case, law school case down in Texas, in which Justice Benson went down the line on so far as our brief was concerned and asked what constituted a first-class law school. And it was impossible for them to put a school up. They said they put up a makeshift school, had one teacher and one pupil, and called it a law school. And then, in the Oklahoma cases, they had Negroes, they admitted them, but they didn't allow them to sit in the dining room, didn't allow them to sit in the library, had Negroes sitting outside the room, and those things. I mean, it was never clear cut. The only clear cut decision we got was Gaines' case against Missouri. Charter carried at the Supreme Court, and we never got a chance to test it, because once we got the decision, Gaines disappeared, and we think it was foul play, but we had no proof. Nobody's ever heard from him since the decision.
I never knew of that part of it. I guess I knew that nothing is told of what happened after the decision, and little is known of Gaines. I didn't realize he had disappeared.
He disappeared.
Which may say something again about the hazards of individuals as plaintiffs.
Oh, yeah, gosh, I can tell you about people. All they did was be officials of the NAACP, like Mr. and Ms. Moore down in Florida, and like Edwards in Mississippi, blasted it. Yeah. And Arthur Shores was a lawyer. The house was dynamited. All kinds of, the three young men that were killed during, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, during the civil rights walk, marches. It was just something that happened, but there's so many things that happened before that.
Could we go back for just a minute to preparing for the trial of the Button case? There are the two cases, and you were the more involved in
They see, after we filed, I was in the trial of the three. We had a three-judge court original to try the case. That eliminated the necessity of going to the Court of Appeals. And they sent us to back to the state. That's when I dropped out of the case. I think Bob probably handled the case by himself. I'm not sure about that, but he may have had other help. But I, in spot, I don't know who finished up with the body for legal defense, because Spot became dean of the law school, and later became before the case was ended, he became a United States District Judge, Thurgood became a second court judge while the suit was pending. So I have to really look at the case itself.
You're still listed as on the brief with Judge Carter as counsel of record in the Virginia Supreme Court in 1960.
Yeah.
So at that stage you were still 60, actively involved.
Yeah, in 60 I was still partially involved. Because all I was doing then was campaigning. But you see, what happened was, well, see, all these things, there's always a wheel within a wheel. And if you start to tell part of it, you got to go to something else. When the thing was over, the campaign was over, they asked me what I wanted. Well, I knew that anything I wanted would require Senate confirmation. And so I just told them nothing. You know, I wasn't going to let Harry Bush, see, I was personally obnoxious to him, and blocked the appointment. So, but later, they asked me as a party member to take a scheduled C job to block somebody. They didn't want to. He was classified employee, but they didn't want him to take the job because they didn't think he was going to do anything with it. And so that's what got me into politics.
It's easy to forget that the fall of 1960 was a time of great political activity.
This is 61, see now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm saying that during 60 I was involved involved in the campaign. But Tucker came up to you. Tucker and I had been, in 1940, well, that's an interesting story, too. When I decided to go to law school, I found that I needed one more credit quarter in foreign language and the rest of the grade points that I hadn't, while I've been happy-go-lucky, I hadn't taken anything but required subjects. And then I could go to law school after conclusion of my junior year and get my AB degree after conclusion of my first year in law school. So that's what I did. And so that fall, Tucker was a freshman in 1929, coming into Howard. And I was took Latin, and decided to take Latin for that quarter, they said it'd be useful for a lawyer. So, and that's where I first met him. But in 1940, when I finished college, he when I finished law school, he finished college. And we ran into each other one day downtown. I was working at Old Donald Cafe down 12th and E. And he was, you know, what you doing and that sort of thing. And we found that he was studying for the bar and I was studying for the bar. His father had joint offices with a lawyer in over in Alexandria, and he was in real estate and insurance business. And the lawyer, Tucker was rather precocious, and the lawyer had took an interest in him. So from the time he was about 12 years old, he was working in the office every summer and in the evenings after school. So when by the time he finished law school, by the time he finished college, rather, he felt he was qualified to take the bar, and he was. And so we studied that summer and fall together. For I'd go to Alexandria and carry my Woodbury notes. Remember Woodbury? Okay, that's for your time. Okay, Woodbury notes. I had Woodbury notes, and from he was a law professor down at William and Mary, and Tucker was studying the notes, and I studied 1924 code that they had then in their office. And so we took the bar together, and we both passed. And so in 1940, we decided, he was dissatisfied in Alexandria, and I had come to Richmond. And we decided to form a firm. But when he got back to Alexandria, he found his greetings, because while he was in college, he had taken the ROTC training and graduated as a second lieutenant. I was anti-military all the time. They had cadet corps at high school. I drilled one year, and I found out how you could avoid it, and I did. And I drilled 2 years of ROTC as compulsory at Howard. I drilled 2 years of compulsory, and I learned how to avoid it, and I did. Well, didn't have to avoid it. It was only compulsory for 2 years. After 2 years, you take the advanced training, and end up with an office, you know, commission, if you were successful. Okay, I don't know where in the world I stopped, so we start over again.
So that's an association that really goes way back.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, so Tucker,
the roots of this firm.
That's right. That's what it was. I was just tying you up with Tucker. So when Tucker, in the late 50s, Tucker was down. We had carried him down to Emporia, because when he came out of the Army, we didn't have any space for him. He would have joined the firm then, but we didn't have any space for him. So we carried him to Lawrenceville, South Hill and Emporia. He wanted to start in Lawrenceville, but he couldn't get the only available office space. The owner of it wouldn't rent it to him, because he didn't want a lawyer there stirring up things, he said. He ended up going over to Emporia, which was a much better town. Anyway, but he was lucky in that respect, because Lawrenceville was practically dead. But Tucker came to Richmond, and I was thinking maybe Tucker had taken over. He was involved in so many of things with us from about 1950 on down the line, because Tucker was involved a whole lot in the litigation on where we were challenging the statutes and hearings by the legislative committees. But anyway, so Tucker came in, and I called. Henry was in the Labor Department up here in Washington, and I had told him he had expressed an interest in coming to Richmond. He was from Richmond. He expressed an interest in coming back, so I called him and told him to come back. And he did. He came on back down and joined Tucker. And that's when I was... Oh. That's where that ended. Go ahead.
I suppose you were not surprised when you lost in the Virginia Supreme Court.
Oh, no. I said, man, we never expected to. We set out preparing record to go to the Supreme Court of the United States. That was our idea. See, when Johnson, President Johnson, had discussed this matter with Justice Brandeis, Brandeis is supposed to have told him that so frequently Negro lawyers brought cases up there, but their record was so poor they couldn't do anything with them, even if they wanted to. And so we were record conscious so far as the Supreme Court was concerned. And we were determined to always do two things. One, to bring a good record, get a good case, and make a good record. And also, watch out for possibility of a case giving you, being turned against you. And so we never noticed a case that we carried up that they could use against us. The only case that, to my knowledge, that ran in that problem, it was one that we didn't handle. It was a case brought down in Birmingham by one of King's lieutenants. I forget the preacher's name now. But anyway, it involved his children, and it gave us a lot of trouble before the courts of appeals, but we never carried it up to the Supreme Court, so.
Dillsworth.
Huh?
Was it Dillsworth? Reverend Dillsworth?
Who?
Reverend Dillsworth.
No, that wasn't the name.
Okay. Duckworth?
No, he was number two man.
Abernathy.
Abbott?
No.
No?
No, I wasn't having that either, I don't think. But that don't sound like the name either. But anyway, it was a case that if we had consulted us, it never would have been brought.
That's fascinating. So you looked upon this case not only as an important one, but as a winner. And by the time you filed the cert, the button. By the time you'd filed the cert petition, you knew this was a potential
winner. As a matter of fact, they knew they weren't doing anything but stolen. See, when I started practicing law, I was spent my elementary school days in Roanoke, and that's where I went back to start to practice. And the circuit court judge, or he was judge of the Hustings Court in those days, was Linz Allman. And he was a fairly decent man, so far as race relations were concerned. But he had been pushed. He was a member of the organization because the judge Birx, was a little too liberal for the organization, so we wouldn't reelect him. And they reached out and got Linz Allman because they didn't want the Commonwealth Attorney for personal reasons. I mean, he was an alcoholic. So they put Linz Allman up, and Judge Linz was a pretty fair judge, and when Woodrum retired to take a job in New York as counsel for some organization, Ninja ran for Congress from the 6th District, and he had the support of Negroes, labor, and everybody, but of course being a member of the organization and the story goes, Harris showed him the heights that he could go to. And as another thing that entered the picture at that time was Abram Staples was elevated. He was Attorney General. He was elevated to the Supreme Court of Virginia. It's called the Court of Appeals of Virginia. And then they sent Allman down to be the acting Attorney General, and with the idea that he would be the next governor, and but it didn't work out that way because the story goes that Mrs. what's the what's the old furniture people over there in Martinsville? Stanley. Mrs. Stanley, who was multimillionaire, told Harry that she thought her husband Stanley ought to be the next governor. And she was a big contributor to the party. Alman was just a poor boy. So Stanley became the party's, the organization's candidate. And he wasn't particularly desired by a whole lot of the organization people. But Harry Burr's word was law, and that was it.
Fascinating.
So they passed over. They passed over. They passed, what I was getting at was they passed over Almond. Well, during the interim, Almond and I used to talk a whole lot, and when they were doing passing some of these daggone laws, he admitted they were damn fool laws, but they did them anyway. And then when he decided that he's going to outdo the organization on segregation, and he got to be, so he jumped out in front, put it announced early, and got to be a pity man, whatever allows the segregation sort to be. That's where what he ended up being. I called him up one day and said, you know, I had anticipated that when you ran for governor, I'd be able to support you. But you know, ain't no way in hell I could support you. Now he said, oh no, I know it all, but you know what the score is, and we forget about it. So that's the way that ended.
Did you ever have any rapprochement with him in later years, or was that essentially your?
Well, yeah. when after he got elected, he didn't have a big ball. He said he was going to invite the public, and he had a big reception at the Capitol. So I happened to see it in the newspaper, and I was at a fraternity meeting one night, and I told the guys I'm going to go down and attend the governor's reception. Anybody want to go with me? So two or three of them said they would go, but we came up tonight to go down, didn't one guy show up, a boy named Harris. But anyway, we went, it was raining that night, and we got in line, walked, finally got up there. And I startled him when he looked up and saw me. Oh, I'm so glad to see you. And when he got there, I heard his ass. He was so startled that even he passed me along to his wife. He said, Ms. Hill, I want you to meet him. we had a fine time. We don't want two Negroes there, of course. But we had a fine time. We stayed through the reception. They had nice food and everything. Everything was fine.
That's a delightful account of, and maybe not a happy ending, but at least it's a slightly different ending. Josh had a question about, and we're about at that stage in the process, about the two cases.
Well, actually, another question came up. When you first filed suit, did you challenge the statute on solely on the 14th Amendment, or did you at that time also challenge it on the basis of the First Amendment?
Gosh, I forgot. I think we limited it to the 14th Amendment. I don't recall dealing too much with the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. I think we limited it to the 14th Amendment.
Okay. Yeah, the First Amendment issue certainly.
I know what the First Amendment is, but I'm saying
it came. It was certainly present, wasn't it, at the time of the Virginia Supreme Court?
There were First Amendment issues involved, of course, but I think we, in fact, all our precedents were under the 14th Amendment, and I'm sure that's what we stuck with.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
After the decision I'm sorry.
But you must remember now, this, we've been battling this thing now for 20, around 30 years.
After the Virginia Supreme Court decision, the NAACP appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Legal Defense Fund case went back to the Federal District Court.
Yeah.
What was the reason for that?
Well, as I recall, I remember discussing that with Bob, and we decided that I wonder when you're going back to go directly to the Supreme Court. Now, my recollection is that we got away with it, but I'm not sure.
And there was a question of, well, I guess it was whether this is a final judgment right. for Supreme Court review purposes. I'd forgotten that there was even a question about the finality of judgment, because the Supreme Court, as I remember, now Justice Frankfurter having retired during the summer and Justice Goldberg having replaced him, this had become, in a matter of a few months, a very different and much more, I guess you can say, activist court by the fall of 1962. They weren't going to let some claim about the finality of the judgment stop them from getting at this issue. So there could have been even more serious procedural barriers, I think, and the Supreme Court would have found a way to get to the merits. They were just very anxious. This somehow seemed to fit in the array of issues, particularly with Justice Goldberg now having joined the court.
Getting away from the legal aspect for a second, I'd be very interested in just hearing a few comments on some of the personalities involved in the case. Could you tell us a little bit about Robert Carter, when you first met him, and what he was like to work with?
Oh, he's very easygoing guy to work with. Bob, shortly after he finished law school, he became engaged with the NAACP. And he became Thurgood's assistant. They got along very well, and he was a he was a hard worker and conscientious sort of person. He liked Grand Opera. He was one of those kind of people. I mean, he wasn't, I don't think he would have known what to do if he'd hang out with a bunch of guys down Second Lee. That's around the corner here. But as I say, he loved Grand Opera, and he was sort of aloof a little bit in that respect, but other than that, he was fine. So.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship. I'm sorry.
Huh? Now, you know, he and, I don't know whether it was Bob's idea or whether it was the psychologist. Well, I can't bring his name up right this moment, but who had the idea of using the psychological?
Kenneth Clark.
Huh?
Kenneth Clark?
No, not Kenneth. This was. He used Kenneth, but I mean, but somebody else came up with the idea first. He used to teach at Lincoln. Sure. It's two fellows with the same name, and I can't think of either one of them. I mean, I can think of the two people, but I can't bring the name up right this moment. But anyway, I don't remember whether this fellow from Lincoln, the teacher, came to Bob, or whether Bob thought it went to him. But anyway, they arranged for the psychological evidence, and. Then, of course, they engaged Kenneth, and Kenneth had a wide range of contacts, and Kenneth helped a whole lot. And then in recruiting high-ranking psychologist and getting cooperation from him. And when you started, you asked me another question.
I was just—you said you were classmates with Thurgood Marshall. I was just going to ask you a little bit about your relationship with Thurgood Marshall over the years.
we were friends from time we met in law school until he died. But it's really funny. The class was evenly divided, and somebody heard one of the, they were at Howard in those days, fraternities were a big issue. And Thurgood was Alpha, Phi Alpha. I was Omega Psi Phi. Some other boys were Kappa Alpha Psi. And then there was Phi Beta Sigma. Those were the four fraternities at Howard. Then there was, of course, some non-fraternal. But anyway, this guy claimed that one of the alphas said, oh, they can run this class because they got half of the class, alphas. And so he was lamenting this fact. I said, well, don't worry about it. Let's do something about it. So we organized the rest of the class, including the non-fraternity were there. And so I was leader of that half, and Thurgood was the leader of the alphas. So anything that Thurgood and I could agree on happened. If we shouldn't agree, it didn't happen. So we had a nice time. We would discuss something, and it was obviously, I wasn't going to let him be president of the class, and he wasn't going to let me be president. And from that point on, we never discussed it. And Washington Post one day, when we were seniors, carried an article saying the class had never had class, they never had any class officers.
Perfect balance of perfect power, one might say.
I don't think we kept a perfect balance out of that, but anyway, we maintained it the same way down the line. But, and then see, the first year we sort of bound things up. But we'd get out of school at 11:30. At the class was collapsed out at 11:30. I had a job over Connecticut Avenue, Stoneley Court apartments at 5. I'd leave school at 5 o'clock, and Thurgood would leave about the same time to go catch the train to go back to Baltimore. He never moved to Washington. He lived in Baltimore, and we would go for lunch down 9th Street to a Father Divine restaurant. That was back in the days when it had all these prophets, and Daddy Grace and Father Divine and Elder Michelle and all of them. But anyway, Father Divine had these restaurants, and he'd walk in and say, "Peace, just truly wonderful." And you get a wonderful meal for about 25 cents. And we were regular customers for that 25-35 cent meal. And so we'd go get dinner, and then we'd come back, and we'd study for then until time for me to go to work and for him to go catch the train. And we did that the whole year. So all these things in combination made us pretty tight.
It's one common link amongst many of the players. A common link between all the players in NAACP v. Button and other civil rights cases is Howard University. Looking back, how much of a role or how much did the environment at Howard Law School contribute to your later efforts?
Oh, the support of law school was tremendous. You see, for one thing, Charlie recruited this young faculty and created quite a stir, because all the, up to that time, from time of its origin until then, Howard had been an evening school with adjunct professors. And now he's come talking about putting in a full-time day school, which knocked out all the adjunct professors mostly, but people it with a lot of young, like Bill Hasty, William Hasty, who became first federal judge, Negro first federal judge, Andy Ransom, who was a member of the Order Corps Law School in Ohio, and a young Jewish fellow, I can't remember his name right now, he was living up in Northern Virginia a few years ago. We didn't keep up with him over the years like I did with some of the others. And Bushek was a big socialist. I thought he was a socialist. I don't know what he was. But anyway, he was a fine man. And then George Hayes was one of the top trial lawyers in the city. Charlie's father was a very good teacher. He was a member of the faculty. And then two or three other members that came, Taylor from Chicago. But there was quite a bit of closeness between so far as Thurgood and me concerned. We're close with Bill Hasty and Andy Ransom and Charlie Houston and George Hayes. So James Neighbors came, he developed a course in civil rights, and that became rather well known. And we had a lot of other young faculty moving in there. Bob Ming came from Chicago. He was a very brilliant young man. So the school was very good. And the other thing was, back in starting with the Gaines case, prior to the argument before the Supreme Court, we set up a mock court and met with the students and presented the argument. Charlie presented his argument to the students and let them criticize him and that sort of thing. And we did a whole lot of that. And in fact, all the important cases, we'd go up to law school and faculty and the student body would look forward to criticizing or analyzing the argument. Prior to, in preparation for the hearing before the Supreme Court. Anyway, back in those days, you had a little more time in presenting your arguments than you do now. First time I ran this, 10 or 15 minutes, a side business, was down in Atlanta. We took us 3 weeks to try a case, and they gave us 15 minutes to argue it. Mm-hmm. Argue the darn thing. I was disgusted.
That's all I have.
Ruby, anything you'd like to?
Not really. I'm just delighted to be here. Although I learned a lot just listening. I thought I knew a lot about you.
And I thought what?
I thought I already knew a lot about you, but I learned a lot more listening to you. I didn't realize that Tucker did not go to law school.
No, Tucker never went to law school.
That's amazing.
That was, I've always regretted the fact that instead of setting him up down in Southside, that we didn't press him to go ahead on and apply for advanced study at one of the law schools. And I think it would have meant a whole lot to his career. See, most people looked at most of you academicians, you all kind of looked down on folks that didn't go through the process, and in fact, he didn't go to law school. Was a hindrance to him, I think, a little bit in some circles.
I just would like to ask one question. It just dawned on me that the tension between the Legal Defense Fund and the NAACP that manifested itself when I was at Howard coming soon after I got out of law school, was that ever a part of the early concerns of the tension between the Legal Defense Fund and the, was there such thing as tension?
Wait a minute, I didn't get the full purport of your question.
When I graduated from law school and when I was in law school, there was the tension between the Legal Defense Fund, Jack Greenberg and company, and the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall and company. You could just almost feel it. And I just wondered if that was a part of the early days.
No, you see, there was a tension between Thurgood and Greenberg. Greenberg was always Thurgood's assistant.
Well, I guess it's Bob Carter, I should have said. Yeah. Bob Carter and company.
But when they organized the Legal Defense Fund in the 39, the purpose for doing that was to set up a 503 corporation so as to get money and give tax exemption. And it was all one thing. Harry Bird was right on one thing, that is, with one organization. But we never thought about any division. We met, and it was just, Thurgood was the director of the Legal Defense Fund, and he was the special counsel for the NAACP. So he was the head of both things. So when we had meetings, it was just one big happy family. But when it had to split, now you got problem of raising money. And the Legal Defense Fund, having tax-exempt status, had a big edge over NAACP that didn't have tax-exempt status at that stage. And there was great deal of tension. It developed as time went along until they had the explosion, I guess you want to call it, when you had the law case with Brooks representing the NAACP and who was it? What's the guy's name? Big lawyer now. Clinton's friend. Can't think of his name. Big lawyer who was in there in Washington, who's Clinton, big lobbyist. He's Clinton's friend. What's his name? Vernon Jones.
Oh, Vernon.
Yeah. Vernon Jordan. Yeah.
Well, it certainly did have an impact on.
Huh?
Well, that division certainly did have an impact on.
Oh, yeah. But I said, the tension rose and rose until it came to actual legal split.
Yes.
And now we talk about the Legal Defense Fund. See, when it was all one thing, we called the Educational Fund the Ink Fund.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've not only covered our questions, I don't think of anything else, but we have taken probably more of your time than we're entitled to, but we've found it fascinating. Let me just ask, is there anything else about this case that we may have overlooked? For example, its long-term impact. Obviously, we're recreating or revisiting it 36 years later. It's a very significant case.
Oh, well, yeah, if we could have made that stood up, well, that would have been really would upset the whole apple cart because, see, there was more sentiment for segregation than for desegregation. As a matter of fact, it probably still is. I don't know. One of the reasons we got into a whole lot of this problem was up until 54, when the Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional, issued this mandate, and sent it down to lower court to put it into effect immediately. You didn't This is the only time that I know of that they did anything similar to this was back in the days in 1902 when Virginia held its convention to deny Negroes suffrage. That was the express purpose of Colden's convention, was to deny them suffrage and set up segregation and second-class citizenship for Negroes. And then recognizing the fact that after it enacted these provisions, constitutional provisions, state constitutional provisions, that it might not be able to get them passed because with the Negro vote and a decent white vote, the probability might be defeated. So rather than take a chance at it, they proclaimed the constitutional provisions to be law, to be the Constitution of Virginia. And then a Negro lawyer named Hayes and a white lawyer named Weiss, who was a son of one of the last governors of Virginia, Republican governors, Weiss, brought suit. And they didn't get to a hearing until, well, they finally got a full hearing and decision by 1904. The first hearing, Fuller was Chief Justice of the United States, whose district, of course, includes Virginia, ruled that it was moot. The case was moot. And the Supreme Court upheld that notion. I imagine holding that your constitutional rights become moot because somebody goes on, does something, and denies you your rights, and then puts them into effect. And I say, if it done something, they could have done something like that with respect to Plessy case. But other than that, the usual procedure was to put the mandate into effect. Now they. So they carried it over for Brown number two, two in the 55 decision, in which we had us come back and brief and argue a remedy. And that's when Frankfurter came with his all deliberate speed business, which everybody recognized later was a great mistake. But the reason for it, they was trying to pacify the South and ease in segregation without saying we're desegregating. But, I mean, it was just one of those situations where you had to still chopping off the tail inch at a time, chop it off inch at a time, you go on and cut it off in one swap and be done with it.
Oliver, if you had one piece of advice to Howard University law students today, what would that be? You had a chance to tell these youngsters something that would be important to them in their life's work.
I think I could tell them to do would be to determine upon something they want to do in life and focus on it and study. And become as competent as they possibly, as their abilities will make them. You got to focus on things. I was one of these happy-go-lucky. I could pass without too much work, and I did. But when I got focused on trying to do something about elimination of segregation, then that changed my attitude, and I took a different light on both studies and life in general. That would hold not only for law students, it would hold for anybody. You got to determine what you want to do, and if you find you made a mistake initially, don't be afraid to change and do something different. But try to find something you want to do and focus on it become as competent as you can. I would have been a little more hard working maybe if I was starting off with that idea now. Because I thought I moved quite a bit as it was. But I have a little different philosophy in life than most people. I believe you're born, you live, and you die, and that's it. I don't believe in all this afterlife, heaven business, and I don't believe it before life, whatever it was there that nobody can tell us about except that they claim it existed. But so I think you ought to be divide your time up into some reasonable segments and stick with them. For example, you need to work, and you need to educate yourself, and you need to take care of your health, and you need to recreate some. And I try to do those. And I always try to treat other people like I'd like to be treated. I started off as anti-segregationist, just like most segregationists start off as anti-Negro. But they passed over that by recognizing the fact that some white people are decent and some not. Just like some Negroes are decent, some are not. Or some of anything are decent, some are not. And also that most people have more than one, personality or side. For example, if you use a good illustration that everybody knows about, take Thomas Jefferson. He was a slaveholder, but yet still he talked about God granting everybody life, liberty, and so forth. But he didn't practice it. He only limited it to white people in his mind. And just like he give him credit for not being a brutal slaveholder, but he if a slave escaped, he hunted him down, issued rewards for him, and did everything else any other slaveholder would do. And the other thing was, while he didn't go for severe beatings, he would ship him down south, and that was, as the old Western movie would say, a fate worse than death. So you've got to bear in mind that, because I don't want to get into my latest thinking about a whole lot of things here now. We'd be here the rest of the afternoon. but we still got to remember that evolution is a fact of life, and time, things change. And things have changed a whole lot since I was in school, so I know that there are more pressures on kids now than there were when I came along. So, but still, you got to adjust yourself to the times and circumstances and try to do what's right.
Thank you.
So that's very sound advice, and not just for Howard Law students. It should be taken to heart by many others. Well, Mr. Hill, we're deeply grateful to you for visiting with us. If we discover any obvious gaps in here, things that we didn't cover, or if things occur to you, maybe we could reimpose a bit, not such an elaborate way, but I think we've got some good, wonderful raw material to,
I'd be glad to meet with you sometime. I'm not going to be able to do much. I can't read, I can't write, so unless I get order some money from somewhere so I can engage somebody to dictate to, I'll be around you.
Well, we will try to make this conference in some part an embodiment of the guidance and inspiration that you've given us. And for me, coming back to this case after 36, well, almost 37 years now since I first encountered it, a sense of what led to it and what it really meant, how it came to be, is just fascinating. And I think our task now, challenge, is to try to share that with the people at Howard and others whom we hope will attend the conference. And we will keep you posted on the planning for the conference as it goes forward.
Okay. You know, I never had a chance to really meet Justice Brennan, but one time that was in Thurgood's 80th birthday.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I guess I could have met him more times than that, but for some reason or other, it looked like I never got around to it. See, I had two good friends there in the Supreme Court at the same time, Thurgood Marshall and Lewis Powell. And I had known Lewis ever since he was director of the movement to change our city government. But we had worked together in that back in 1947. And then we had worked on several other things. And then we were on the same commission to revise the Constitution of Virginia back in the late 60s. It's real funny. I didn't know that Nixon had offered to appoint Lewis to the Supreme Court, and Lewis had turned him down. And so after, in the early days in the 70s, after the Florida situation, what was the guy's name? Carswell.
Yeah.
After the Carswell fiasco, I ran to him on Broad Street one day. I said, listen, Nixon has made it clear that he's going to appoint a Southerner. So why the devil don't you tell your Republican friends to nominate you? And we can all get behind you and get you elected. And he laughed. He said, oh, I don't know, something like that. But anyway, about 2-3 weeks later, he called me one night and said, they all remember we talked to him on Broad Street? And I said, yeah, I remember us talking, which I said, well, did you mean it? I said, mean what? He said, it means that you were going to support me if I got the nomination. I said, sure, I'll support you. So he said, all right, I got the nomination. You got to support me. Real funny, because both Tucker and Henry opposed him, and I was supporting him. I knew he wasn't inflamed. Of course, I knew him real well, and I knew he wasn't inflamed and liberal. But on the other hand, Nixon was going to appoint a Southern, and I knew all the Southerners I'd heard of, that Powell was about as good as any they're going to get.
And so you get
the best you can get and go on about your business. That's my theory, and that's what happened. But we were good friends up until the time he died, though. We used to have lunch from time to time. I was getting around then. I could go over to his house, and we'd sit down and talk.
Well, as the survivor of this group, I may have mentioned last time that my father-in-law, who was a law school classmate of Bob Ming at the University of Chicago.
Oh, is that right?
Recently, a couple of weeks ago, had his 94th birthday. And he has the same experience that you've had of looking around and realizing that you're about the only person of your generation who's still there.
Yeah.
And it is remarkable for the rest of us that he are still there.
Ask him sometime. Was Bob? I knew Bob was on a state utilities commission. But somebody was somewhere down the line said he thought he was chairman one time. See if you find out for me.
I will. That sounds vaguely familiar. He had been chairman. They were good.
I was on the president's committee for government contract compliance, and I was given the I talked about Bob Ming, and they said, well, if you can get him to be the director, go ahead and get him. So I set up an appointment with Bob and tried to convince him to take the job. But hell, at that time, Bob was doing two or three different things. He wasn't at Howard then. He was still in yeah. Chicago. Yeah. And so we talked about Bob, outlined some things. He'd gotten up to income of $19,000 and still has a couple of other things he hadn't mentioned. So I said, well, listen, this is out on the page, $10,000. So he said, that's about $70,000, doesn't it? I said, I think so.
That's a hard sell. I will find out, and he will surely remember, because he has recently done an autobiography, something called This Lawyer's Life, which goes back really to his childhood in Chicago, and through, he was an undergraduate at Chicago and then stayed on through law school and has practiced all his life until last year. He finally left his firm just last year at 93.
I've been doggone. I quit last year too, but I wouldn't have quit, but I couldn't see.
For those of you who have given so much and so long, it's just a great good fortune that the rest of us are able occasionally to share some of it with you. And we thank you so much for taking this time with us today. And
well, pleasure's all mine, because you feel so much better. You're doing something. Just sitting around looking at C-SPAN is not as...
I know the feeling. My father-in-law is off to the American Law Institute meeting. I guess it's starting Monday.
Oh, yeah.
It's one thing. He always goes to ALI, and he always goes to meetings of the American Arbitration Association. He spent much of his career as an arbitrator. And he says exactly the same thing. He can't do nearly as much as he used to, but he does try to keep active in those few things. Well, we will keep you, I think we're set. We'll keep you posted on our planning in progress.